Friday.
Okay, I'm going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Friday, March 1st, 2013. And this is an informational hearing on the Department of Human Services. Is that, am I saying that right? No, it's, what am I hearing the hearing on? Well, it's not just
PSRB.
The hospital. It's not just the hospital. Bruce, tell us what your title. Thank
How
you.
How about if I come up?
That would be wonderful. It used to be DHS. Now it is
Oregon Health Authority.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you.
You
knew that. Why didn't you tell me?
And I'm here just to kick things off. Rep Tomei and I spoke the other day, and I understand that part of the reason for this hearing, which I think is great, is to talk a little bit about mental health services, and particularly, I think, the interface between mental health and a lot of the issues that you face in on the Human Services Committee. Several years ago, we had a large Department of Human Services, which included health programs as well as human service programs. We've split those two functions, and as you know, the Department of Human Services and its role, and the Oregon Health Authority is responsible for the state's health, mental health, public health programs, public employee purchasing of health care, and Oregon educators. When it comes to mental health issues, it's certainly a fundamental issue and a concern for us as we look to do a couple of things. One is certainly create a healthier state. Two is to reform our healthcare system. Three, improve people's lives. We see that untreated mental health and substance abuse problems really are a root cause issue for a number of the things that you deal with. Most of the children in our foster care system are there because their parents have untreated mental health and substance abuse disorders. Much of what we see in corrections is as a result of untreated mental health and substance abuse disorders. We know that in our healthcare system, individuals with chronic illness, their outcomes are worse and their costs are much higher if individuals have mental health problems. And we've been struggling in this state to, I think, create the kind of mental health system that all of us would be proud of as a result of what's been, you know, in many ways about 8 years of budget reductions and an inability to fund a lot of these important programs. Having said that, I think one of the things I'd want to be certain to leave you with today is that we really have a great opportunity in front of us coming January 1, 2014, that one of the opportunities for this state with the Affordable Care Act and federal health reform is the ability to bring 180,000 low-income adults into the Oregon Health Plan. And what that will mean is that individuals today who, these are particularly adults between the ages of 18 and 65, living in poverty, who cannot get onto the Oregon Health Plan, they will now be eligible for services on the Oregon Health Plan, meaning that their mental health care and substance abuse treatment will be covered. I think that is going to be a huge change in our communities come January 1, 2014. I think what that's going to mean is that now counties that have been really struggling to provide services for indigent mental health care will see the numbers of people who are uncovered for those services decrease anywhere between 50% and 75%, if not more, in many counties. Community corrections, which has been providing outpatient mental health and addiction services for individuals. We'll see the majority of those individuals now covered on the Oregon Health Plan. So I think that we have an opportunity over the next couple of years to really strengthen our mental health services. The governor's budget makes a 43% increased investment in community mental health services, and I know that Senator Courtney has been working on his own proposal to do that as well. So I think that we're hopefully at a turning point in our state when it comes to creating the kind of mental health care system that we need. I think that we can do that with some of the help we're getting with federal health reform, and that we really have an opportunity to make some pretty profound changes in people's lives. I think you'll hear about in more detail about our mental health system from the folks that follow, but I just wanted to introduce that concept with you today and make certain you are aware of what I think is an opportunity to really change things out into the future.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, thanks for being here. And I don't know, you probably know this answer, but and you might be the wrong person to ask, though, too. Okay, so I'm on this Commission on Public Safety, and we're moving forward with what we're trying to do with prison reform. I know and I have learned that those who are incarcerated under DOC are not eligible for federal dollars.
Correct.
Does that work also then for those in the mental health side that are incarcerated like that?
Chair Tomei, Rep. Olson, members of the committee. If you are incarcerated, you're not eligible for Medicaid and the federal funds that come along with that. When you are no longer incarcerated and come out of correctional institutions, we can then get people onto Medicaid.
Okay.
And we've been working over the last several years with the Department of Corrections on being certain that we could seamlessly be able to identify individuals, get them signed up on day one when they come out so that there isn't a lapse in coverage and that individuals could get medications. What we've been hampered by is not having the funding in our Oregon Health Plan Standard Program to be able to have all of those individuals come into care. But no federal Medicaid funding while in the Department of while in a correctional institution.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Goldberg, I'm going to sort of follow up on what Representative Olson was asking about. He and I both are on the Judiciary Committee. We had a hearing this last week about the people who are on the street who are mentally ill. And there are services out there, but if they don't have insurance, either through the health and OHP or something else, they can't get the services that are available. I understand it's going to be opening up for 180,000 people, but I think some of the people that we heard about, they probably will not be in the position that they will even apply to be on the Oregon Health Plan. So is there anything in the works for those people, crisis services or some kind of wraparound services for people who have no health insurance and are not on the Oregon Health Plan?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee. So two different issues. One is individuals who will potentially be eligible but haven't applied or one of the things that we are working on is a new eligibility and enrollment system that will provide more real-time eligibility so that when individuals come into nonprofit organizations in the community or into hospitals, emergency departments, you name it, we'll be in a much better place to facilitate enrollment and coverage. Now, there will still be individuals that will not be, indigent individuals that will not be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. Those will primarily be individuals who, based on their citizenship status, don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan. There will be and are services available through the funds that go to counties now for some of that crisis care, wraparound services, et cetera.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Kingire.
Thank you. Hi. When people are still in the DOC system but maybe at a halfway house, and I don't know a lot about that system, are they available? Is Medicaid available to them under those conditions?
Chair Tomei, Rep. Kingire, members of the committee, I do believe, and when it gets into the interface with the laws around corrections, out on the edge, but I believe that when you're living in the community and no longer in a correctional institution, that you are eligible for Medicaid, and I will check that.
I think you're right, because it's a transitional period.
Exactly.
So.
But I will find that out with some certainty.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Dr. Kohler, if you could clarify the comment you just made with regard to people lacking citizenship. Do we have anything in place that would cover undocumented immigrants?
Chair Tomei, Rep. Gallegos, members of the committee, there are certain federal standards around Medicaid coverage that deal with citizenship. For individuals that don't qualify for Medicaid based on their citizenship status, there are a couple of things. One is there is a program called CALM, Citizen Alien Waiver Emergency Medical, something to that effect. And what that does is it provides coverage for a small list of emergency services for individuals that are non-citizens. It's not for routine care, not for primary care. The other programs that we have is a very strong network of federally qualified community health centers. And certainly those federally qualified community health centers see a fair number of individuals that don't qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, although that is only for primary care. And oftentimes it's very difficult for individuals living in our community who don't qualify for the health plan to get specialty care and other care paid for.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none. Thank you so much, Dr. Goldberg.
My pleasure.
Today. Now we will have, I'm sorry, the agenda is, I should have looked at it more closely. So I'm going to have Linda Hammond come and talk with us about addictions and mental health.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Linda Hammond. I'm the Interim Director for Addictions and Mental Health. I'm going to attempt to do my own presentation here, so if I lose you, I apologize. I'm usually pretty good. See, I did it wrong. I should never say that. So I've got help coming. Excellent. Today I was asked to come before you and talk to you about the addictions and mental health system within the Oregon Health Authority and how the system is structured and how we interact with our community partners and what our system covers. So the goals of the Addictions and Mental Health Program are to assist Oregonians to achieve optimum physical, mental, and social well-being by providing access to an array of behavioral health services and supports. AMH-supported programs contribute to the Oregon Health Authority's transformation goals of better health, better care, and lower cost. improving lifelong health for all Oregonians through prevention, through improving quality of life for the individuals that we serve, increasing effectiveness of integrated healthcare delivery systems, and reducing overall health care and societal costs.
Linda, I'm going to stop you just for a second. I think one of the bullet points was improving lifelong health for Oregonians through prevention. This committee is particularly interested in prevention. So if when you get to those points, I know you're going to be talking about gambling, addiction, and other mental health issues. If you could stress a little bit more what's going on about prevention of these problems, that would be really helpful.
Chair Tomei, I'd be happy to do that as we go through them. I'm also happy to answer any questions or clarify.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Gallegos.
Can I point out that we spent like at least a good week going through these slides in another committee, so I hope it'll go faster than me. But
it sounds like he's complaining there.
No.
I think you spent, 8 days on it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Representative Tomei, Representative Chaos. Actually, it was 3. It most probably felt like 8. I apologize for that. I can tell you that the last day, the Thursday of testimony by the constituents that came to talk to us, by far was the most impacting and, for me, empowering piece of what we do. It really brought home why we come both into this building and into our jobs every day, and it talked a lot about prevention and peer support services. So I consider it an honor to be before you, and I hope I make it shorter this time than last time.
This is the Ways and Means Committee that Representative Gallegos is a member of.
So AMH manages the behavioral health system through strategic use of program and financial data, working closely with other department units to ensure effective financial management and system performance of the behavioral health system. Our staff focus on 4 community program areas. Those areas are community mental health, prevention of substance abuse and problem gambling disorders, alcohol and drug treatment, and problem gambling treatment.
So, Linda, could you stop there and talk some about prevention of substance abuse and problem gambling disorders? I think what we've heard here over and over again in this committee and over the years that I've been on it is that prevention is much more effective, efficient, and humane. And so I think we're particularly interested in what is being done regarding prevention of these disorders.
Chair Tomei. In the arena of prevention, we constantly come to the realization of many things. One, first of all, being to understand mental illness and addictions issues, you really have to understand what mental health is and what healthy behaviors are. And when you deal with the prevention arena, you start with the early education of working with communities at every level. Any single touch point that we have with an individual is a critical touch point in our system. It may be our only touch point. If somebody comes into a facility and presents a situation, whether it be to a physician, whether it be to a social services network organization, it's important that we maximize that contact and not only discuss the exact thing that's being presented to us, but also look at the full array of what they're talking about. And as you look at working with children, working with adolescents, and working in other arenas of prevention, both in drug, mental health, addictions, because we do have that full array throughout our children's system and our adult system. You will hear stories of individuals who don't know where to go, who know something is wrong, who can't quite get to the understanding of what it is that's causing the situation, but they want to reach out for help. So prevention begins with early education and really helping to understand within a community, both within our schools and other arenas, on what health, mental health, and healthy behavior looks like. It then provides the opportunities, which can be some of the lowest cost, most impacting opportunities to intervene. For example, if you look at the ESA program, The ESA program is one I'll talk to you more at length of as we go through.
Could you tell us what those letters mean?
Sure, and I'm going to turn to the right page because I always want to scramble this one around. It's the Early Assessment and Support Alliance, and that is a program that works with early identification of children with specific diagnoses. And we've actually proven that if you, through this work, we can reduce 75% of emergency room visits. We can actually get children onto a very healthy path, and they can become fully functioning in school, fully functioning in their community. Their families are more successful. And again, they move on to become very, very active, and if you could have heard yesterday, very powerful speakers about the difference that prevention, early intervention, peer support services, supportive housing, all the components that really make up the cadre of supports that are needed as we deal with their mental health and also their physical health needs.
Thank you, Linda.
That's available to us, isn't it? The video of the session from yesterday, the Ways and Means Committee meeting?
I don't know.
Should be, isn't it? I mean, these things are taped, right?
It's available on the public.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have this weekend off. You might as well check it out. It was very touching testimony.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm going to have this weekend off.
You give it a second weekend homework.
Give me some homework, yeah.
At least it wasn't me trying to give you homework. That's a much better arrangement. Continue things that we look from for our goals, for our programs, and expectations of their outcomes. AMH operates also the Oregon State Hospital services on three campuses. One campus and one secured operated 16-bed residential facility. So that is the hospital component of the entire community mental health continuum. AMH is responsible for program development, performance management, administrative rule development, system planning, coordination, quality improvement, certification, technical assistance, consultation, and something not written, but I believe implicit in everything we do, partnerships with our partners and support of our vulnerable populations and how we change ourselves and work collaboratively to improve the way we do business to really have an impacting mental health and addiction service. The mission of AMH is to assist Oregonians achieve optimal physical, mental, and social well-being by providing access to health, mental health, and addiction services and supports to meet the needs of adults and children to live, be educated, work, and participate in their communities. Oregon's mental health system dates to 1883 with the creation of the Oregon State Hospital. The community mental health system was created in 1971 and includes substance abuse services. Our services in our community-based mental health system are provided through our community mental health programs, the tribes, and subcontractors. Addictions and Mental Health does not provide any direct service. It's all through the local community network of providers. The next slide really presents to you, as we were talking about earlier, the continuum. It's the Institute of Medicine Spectrum of Intervention. It really is a framework for how you think about, talk about, and operate within the arena of achieving improved mental health and addiction services. And the prevention is vital, and I was asked by the other committee, so I'll clarify. The reason for the two colors on the slide is the first area, the paler, interesting green color, is the broader type of connection that we have. It is more about the general population, the larger risk groups, and then moving into how we refine that into diagnosis. Then you're getting into specific case identification, treatment, compliance with long-term treatment, and aftercare. So the turquoise type color is more of the individual type of focus that we have. The first three areas are as we move from the broader population through into the more specific care. And it is true to say that the continuation of prevention treatment and the ongoing maintenance cannot operate independently of each other. Prevention is a critical component. Education in prevention is vital, but it would be lax of us to educate our families, our individuals, on what mental health is and treatment is, and then have no service delivery system to provide that care that is needed. So sometimes it can be look very attractive just to do the education piece because they tend to be the lower dollars and yet a broad impact, but truly can be some of the most frustrating for our families because they want to not only know how to engage with our systems and how to help their children and their loved ones, but then they have to have mechanisms behind it, and those mechanisms need to be thoughtfully approached both on an urban, rural, and a frontier type county structure, and we have to think about our system in the best way to maximize all those services, and it needs to be able to respond in different ways. So services and support organizations again can be organized around the same framework: prevention and behavioral health promotion, community substance abuse and problem gambling prevention is one area that I'm highlighting here, and those have goals to reduce risk factors, increase protective factors through policy, environment, individual, family, school-based, and community strategies. So this is the strategic organization around using data, using evidence-based practices, and then having the spectrum of engagement around prevention services. The early identification and intervention, the systemic events, these are aimed at identifying individuals with early signs of mental health, substance use, and gambling problems. Examples of this, again, are the ESA program, which I think many of you may know of. It is a nationally recognized, now it was started in Oregon. It came from a program that was in Australia. And it has now it's operating in 17 counties in Oregon. And it has amazing results. And it is a piece of our governor's recommended budget to expand that to be statewide. And it really is something that families can speak very passionately and individuals can speak very passionately about the difference it makes.
Thank you. You said it came to Oregon. Is it also in other states in the United States?
Representative Tomei, Representative Kenegaya, actually we're the first state to take it on. Other states are doing that sort of work under a slightly different name, but they're also looking at the ESA program itself. We tend to be somewhere the other states come to look at the program because of its success.
And one more question, Madam Chair. Thank you. And how long has it been going in Oregon?
I believe now we are in our fifth year. Then we also have the DUII offender screening, brief intervention, and referral treatment. DUII offenders program. We have the screening, brief intervention, and referral treatment known as ESPERT. This is a process of early engagement and identification of the broader spectrum of mental health needs.
Madam Chair, we have a bill in judiciary we're listening to right now that has a little bit of a connection going on here. It's House Bill 2116 deals with the ignition interlock devices and their involvement right now that we're having to try to deal with. So, I mean, not that I want them to explain that or anything like that, but it's a piece that doesn't fit with where we're wanting to go right now, and I'll explain that to you a little later.
As you continue on the spectrum of treatment and services, early intervention treatment and services, we get to our standard outpatient treatment. This is comprised of community-based services and supports for individuals with diagnosed behavioral health conditions, mental health, substance use, and problem gambling disorders. Examples include regular outpatient, intensive outpatient, medication, medication-assisted treatment, care coordination, case management, psychiatric day treatment, and skill training. Our residential treatment system include mental health, alcohol and drug, problem gambling residential treatment for individuals with more serious complicated illnesses. So this is another piece of that continuum as it flows through the system. Primarily delivered by private nonprofit organizations in community settings. So these again are the community type of facilities that are around the state and have the various levels of support systems, from a secure residential treatment facility to a residential treatment facility to supportive housing, and then the supportive services that relate to what we call AIM High, which is our program that really supports individuals to live as independently as possible, but wraps around mental health system, mental health care. The idea with all of this is to move people to the most independent living state that they can be in. So the goal is a key to your own front door, and that's the wish of most of us. And so we really support that. And we want to only utilize the higher cost areas of system when needed, for as long as needed, but then have the mechanism in the community to get folks home, to get folks successful and contributing back in their community.
Thank you. I just want to make a statement, and I'll get to you in just a minute. I think that statement is so important, colleagues, because I think that's one of the things we've learned about the state hospital. It is not a place that you go to live. It's a place you go to get well and move out, and with the aim of having a key to your own front door. It's not that we're going to have people end their days in the state hospital. So thank you for that, Linda. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on your emphasis on, particularly on gambling addiction prevention, obviously because we've been working on that and there are a few bills pending in this committee, and recognizing that you can't separate or silo these difficult problems. They are all many times interrelated in the same family, the same person still. And maybe you're going to say this later, but what could you say about our, I don't want to say effectiveness, I guess, but at least are we approaching meeting the needs of the majority of identified problem gamblers in this state, or are we grossly behind? Where, give me some kind of a gauge on what these programs are doing for that group.
Representative Tomei, Representative Gilliam, you're going to see a slide in shortly, but I can tell you that for problem gambling specifically, we actually provide services to about 2% of the individuals that need, are recognized to need the type of gambling assistance programs. It's not the huge numbers related to mental health, addictions, and the other areas, but when you look at an impact statement that shows you that we're only impacting 2%, I think that presents a picture for you. The effectiveness of them, I can tell you, we have a very high success rate of effectiveness in our programs. It's the ability to access the programs and to have enough programs available to provide the services.
Thank you. I'll look forward to those slides.
Okay, great. Linda, I'm concerned about the time. We had hoped to spend the bulk of our time on the state hospital and on the psychiatric review board. I was wondering if you would mind coming back at a later time. Is there anything else that we should see before we start talking about the state hospital? I've already got your slides from the Ways and Means Committee.
Chair Tomei, I apologize. It's me this time that's causing this to be a long
time. No, you're doing just fine.
It's just a lot of information.
I get very passionate about
we are too, and we want to have you come back and finish this up.
Absolutely, and I'm very, very happy to do that. I just would want to draw your attention to the drivers, the factor presentation here that you have before you on the screen, and this is where it really does show that the problem gambling, we reach 2% of the individuals. If we look at the people we serve in the other age categories, we have 20%, 26% under 17 and 18% over 18 in addictions, and then the other percentages. Now, admittedly, there are services that are provided through health insurance plans that address some of this need, but what you need to understand is that health insurance plans do not cover some of the most critical components, such as housing, peer support services, the wraparound services that we talk about. So there is limited access in both children and adults to the services, whether they have health insurance or not. And I can tell you that our mental health population are very poorly represented in having mental health services. And we see the change as they go from the children's system into the adult system. We see that change happen because they cannot hold down a job or be successful in a job that comes with a health insurance package. So I did want to point out that, and I also wanted to point out that we did have the settlement in November signed with the USDOJ, which has some requirements and some benchmarking of some data that we'll be doing, and we'll be continuing to work with them through the next, I believe, 5 years as we move forward with these areas, and they cover everything from crisis services all the way through the continuum.
Linda, mention that, let's see, we have one semi-freshman here. One and a half freshmen here who don't understand, I think, probably about the DOJ. So could you talk some about that briefly?
The U.S. DOJ, we've been in conversations with them on two different occasions now, both with the replacement of the Oregon State Hospital, which we successfully navigated with the building of the new facilities and the moving people.
Talk about their concerns, please.
And
why they got involved.
They got involved because of the condition of the individuals living, the treatment, and we're really concerned about not only how we were able to provide living accommodation, but the quality of care associated with that. So within the hospital, we've been able to move to a much more robust system, which Greg Roberts will be able to talk to you about the differences we've made within the care system, the hospital care system. We've always said right from our beginning that we had to have significant investment in the community mental health system to achieve the reduced beds that we've talked about in the design of the state hospital, and that is that's through Olmsted. Our expectation is to move away from hospitalization and have people again key to their own front door. We're now working through some data points with the USDOJ to outline where we are in our systems, and then we will continue to meet with them regarding gaps in our system and what we're doing as a state to address those gaps as we move forward, both in partnership with the CCOs, but also in our broader, larger crisis response system and other areas of the state.
And as I recall from reading materials from the DOJ, USDOJ, was that that's a big issue for them right now is the community services that we provide to keep people out of the hospital, as well as services for people leaving the hospital.
Representative Tomei, yes, I was part of the negotiation in the 16 months I've been in this position, and we spent many hours, and they have a lot of passion, and they are working very closely with us. It is a partnership right now. They're very excited about where Oregon's going, but they also will be working alongside of us to make sure we continue to reach the goals that we've mutually agreed on.
And I think this committee is very interested in that. We'd like to bring you back and hear from you more in depth about what's happening, what needs to happen, and what it is that we need to do to facilitate that happening.
Representative Tomei, I would be more than happy to come back and try and be a little more concise next time.
You were just fine. You've done what we asked you to do, and we'll ask you to do more next time.
Thank you
so much, Linda. Thank you. With that, we're going to call up Greg Roberts. Greg wasn't on the agenda, and again, that's my fault. I apologize for that. Greg Roberts is the director of the State Hospital.
And good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I am superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital in the position since September 2010. Relative to what's been discussed just a few minutes ago, this is an abbreviated version of what some of you have seen Ways and Means the other day. We'd like to begin with an introduction about the hospital, and preface this by saying, for those of you as we were just speaking, back to the 2009-2010 time frame, the Oregon State Hospital was in a very different place. The for good reason, in my opinion. The U.S. Department of Justice was interested to assess the conditions at the hospital vis-a-vis a federal civil rights legislation specifically called CRIPA, Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, focused on compliance with the civil rights of institutionalized persons, so right to treatment and right to live in the community if a person doesn't need to be institutionalized, and especially what's called protection from harm, that people should be, their rights should be respected and they should be protected from harm in certain ways while they are hospitalized. So what I would like to lead off with is something I said the other day. The Oregon State Hospital of 2013 is vastly different than the Oregon State Hospital of 2010 in every way. We recently were able to obtain approval from the federal government for recertification of three of our geriatric wards under the CMS program and therefore qualify for federal reimbursement to the tune of probably several million dollars in the upcoming biennium. And when we applied for, those units had been decertified back in 2008, and when the Seattle office asked us why should they, in effect, why should they bother considering recertifying these units, what is different about the hospital, and we happily said everything is different about the hospital, and that's true, and not just the physical facility of the hospital, but the treatment that takes place, and again, compliance with federal civil rights legislation, and I know several of you have come out to the hospital and had a tour and seen it with your own eyes, so, and those of you who have not, please do, because I think you need to see it with your own eyes to really appreciate the change, so. So with that said, we'd like to always to begin with the vision statement of the hospital and the mission. This was literally part of the hospital's transformation starting in 2010, where after so many years of difficult experiences at the hospital, USDOJ being one of them, what we wanted to do was begin the transformation by focusing everyone at the hospital on what are we here for? Why does the state hospital exist? What's our job to do? And so we came up with these simple statements that say our vision statement is that we're a hospital that inspires hope, promotes safety, and supports recovery for all of our patients. Our mission is to provide therapeutic, evidence-based, patient-centered treatment that focuses on recovery and community reintegration, and we want to do that in a safe and therapeutic environment. So many organizations have mission statements that go on for pages and pages. Ours is simply that statement. We think it says it all. Where patients come to our hospital, as Representative Tomei just said, they don't come to live out their lives as people did years ago in state hospitals. Our job is to admit people who are too ill or too dangerous by reason of their mental illness to be in the community, provide them the treatment that they need to help them stabilize, help them recover sufficiently so that they can return to the community. And we take that mission very seriously. We talk about it all the time. The types of people who receive our services, we have several categories of patients. They're all adults, and they, as I said, they're people who are civilly committed or criminally committed to the hospital for mental health treatment. And in 2012, although our average population is in the mid to high 500 range, we provided care and treatment for a total of 1,183 people in 2012. So there was quite a bit of turnover, admissions, and discharges. All of those people came to us because they required what's defined as hospital level of care. As you see the description there, 24-hour nursing, psychiatric care, credentialed professional staff, organized medical staff, etc. And again, the services are essential to restore patients to a level of functioning that they return to the community. The categories of patients are on the civil program. I think I'm supposed to be hitting a button here. So.
People have this on their computers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe not. No, this is the... Where'd Leah go?
Oh.
Do we have ours or no?
It wasn't given to me to download.
Oh, okay. Do you have the hard copy? No, that
I do.
Yes, okay.
Does everybody?
Okay, that's fine.
I'm not sure everybody does.
It's been loaded on OLIS if you...
Oh, yes.
Okay. OLIS. Do you have OLIS?
Okay. Or does you have the hard copy? Yeah.
I do. I don't do OLIS, sorry.
Right. So we have civilly committed people, and a total of 98 beds at this point. 2 years ago, all of our beds for civilly committed patients were in Portland. We closed one of the units in Portland and brought the patients down to the hospital in Salem. That enabled us to double the size of our treatment mall, where people spend the majority of their day attending programs. In Portland, and we do aspire to certify additional beds now in Portland under the CMS program, and again, draw down more federal dollars. But the civilly committed people are under a civil commitment statute or voluntarily committed by a guardian, and they are come to the hospital because the treatment that they need is not available in the community, and we... again, provide services so that they can safely leave the hospital and return to the community. Then we have what's called our neuropsychiatric program, which is often mistakenly called a geriatric program. 60% of the patients in this program are 65 years and older. 40% are not. Those 40% are people with traumatic brain injuries or serious other medical problems. But they're under the age of 65. There are 88 beds, all on our Salem campus, diagnoses such as dementia, organic brain injury, and very frequently with co-occurring significant medical illnesses. So it was a real physical medicine emphasis on those units as much as psychiatric care.
Yes, Representative Kenny Byer.
Yes.
Thank you. We know that part of your mission is focused on recovery, and then there's some things here like brain injury. Are there anyone for which you don't think there's a possibility of recovery? And community
Representative Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, no. We operate on the belief that every patient our job is to stabilize and help every patient recover. Obviously, some are more difficult than others, but we truly believe that every patient is potentially dischargeable.
And is there a maximum amount of time that they can be there?
No, there's not.
Okay. Thank you.
So what would be the longest time anybody who is currently in the hospital has been there?
I happen to have that. it's over 30 years. There's very few patients, but there are some patients in the hospital as long as 30 years.
And would they be the neuropsychiatric patients?
It's likely that they are. Representative Tomei, but the majority, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 patients in the hospital more than 20 years, and the longest is about 35 years.
Wow.
So.
Okay, thank you.
Right. The first line of page 5 is actually should have been under the heading of a GEI, guilty except for insanity. We operate 16 and a half units in Salem and 4 cottages in Salem for this population. These are people who have been convicted of a crime related to their mental illness, they are now, since last year, Senate Bill 420 divides those patients into 2 populations. Tier 1 offenders who are Measure 11 crimes, they are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, PSRB, while they're in the hospital and while they're in the community. Others are Tier 2 patients, lesser offenses. They are under the jurisdiction of the State Hospital Review Panel while they're in the hospital, and they return to the jurisdiction of PSRB when they're returned to the community. Then we have aid and assist population, generally referred to as our 370 patients. 370 are the refers to the statute that enables them to be at the hospital, ordered by a court for mental health treatment that will enable them to understand the criminal charges against them and aid and assist in their defense. So these are people who are evaluated in the first place coming into the hospital as unable to aid and assist in their defense. Our job is to, again, stabilize their condition, restore them to the condition where they are able to aid and assist in their defense, and they return to correctional facilities when they reach that point.
Representative Olson?
Yep.
Thank you. Greg, I'm just curious, as you're talking about aid and assist in the Tier 1 folks right now, what we did from 2 years ago for the PSRB folks, what is the percentage of those that are under aid and assist?
Representative Tomei and Representative Olson and members of the committee, on any particular day, right now, to separate out the two, for the PSRB population, Tier 1 and Tier 2, there are about 300 patients in the hospital today. That's been a pretty steady figure for the year 2012. If you were to look back to 2010, that number was about 350. So there are, on average, 50 fewer PSRB or SHARP Tier 1, Tier 2 patients in the hospital compared to 2 years ago. At a snapshot level, it's actually the next slide, on any moment, there are 120 patients, 370 patients in the hospital today, and I can get you the number of patients we served in 2012, but it's significant turnover. I don't have it here, but I can get it easily for you. Significant turnover, because the length of stay for those patients is only 45 days or so. And so that's, in terms of the number of people served in a calendar year, the 370 population is actually our, by far our largest percentage of patients, the aid and assist restoration.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So slide 6 gives you just a snapshot view of our patients, the breakdown on a particular day. It's very typical of any day. The GEI Tier 1, that's the Measure 11 PSRB, 22%, Tier 2, et cetera. It's worth to combine two lines down, the revocation. Those are also patients who are Tier 1, Tier 2 patients, who came back to the hospital after having violated the conditions of their release in the community. And that can be a multitude of offenses. So the 300-so figure comes from the 134, 77, 62, and 28 added together. Aid and assist, as I said, 120 civil commits between Portland and Salem, and voluntary by Guardian.
That's almost 70% of the patients, isn't it?
70?
Isn't that correct?
It's about right. Usually 70 to 75% of the people in the hospital are forensic patients.
Thank you.
Sorry. To get into some highlights, and again, this speaks to the improvements in the hospital. The transformation of the Oregon State Hospital began in 2010, especially as we began to apply the principles of what's called lean methodology. There was a consultant group called Kauffman Global that we employed that basically educated us about lean methodology. It's used throughout the world. It's used quite a bit in private industry, manufacturing, Toyota production system being the most famous. But it's about performance improvement. It's about elimination of waste, continuous review of your processes to make sure that any redundancies, any wasteful steps, the things that waste time, things that waste space, are eliminated. And so we've been implementing lean methodology for 2 years, continue to grow as we do so, and we just chose a few specific improvements that are noteworthy. I don't think it's any members of this committee, but questions had come up in the past about how long it takes someone to be approved to visit. So if you're family member was admitted to the state hospital, believe it or not, it used to take 43 days for you to get, on average, to be approved to visit because we were doing background checks and other things. And when we looked at that process, there were many redundant steps, unnecessary steps in there. So now it is 48 hours or less. So if a family member comes to the hospital and you apply and we do your background check, you're approved usually within 2 days. This is all to the patient's benefit.
I am really curious about the application of lean methodology, and I think of it as sort of a different organizational system, and I'm just curious. I understand it's aimed at reducing waste, but it's also sort of a more bottom up sort of organization. So basically, you listen to the bottom a lot more than in a hierarchical system. So I'm just curious, is that the way it's working out for you?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gallegos, absolutely. That's how it's how it operates. That the assumption is that people closest to the problem can find the solutions to the problem. So there are work groups called Rapid Process Improvement Initiatives. We have work team initiatives. They always include sometimes patients themselves and staff members on the front line in the resolution of the issues.
Great.
So, yeah. I'd like to tell you this, and I'll hear it again in Ways and Means. Mr. Fred King, I think there's a legislative subcommittee that looks at performance improvement in government, and now three states, Washington, Minnesota, and Mississippi, are consulting with Oregon State Hospital on the implementation of lean methodology. So we think we're leading the curve as the country. It's an interesting process, because so much of lean methodology and things you read about lean are only applied in the manufacturing world. The application to healthcare facilities is it takes some effort to translate. So
I just want to share that I do drive a Prius. So I know about it.
I have a Camry hybrid.
Kenny Geyer.
Yes.
Thank you. So I see your interpretive services here.
Yes.
Do you use culturally competent training at all for your personnel?
Representative Tomei and Representative Kenny Geyer, absolutely, including in our interpreter services as well. We have a cadre of staff who have been identified as being able to be interpreters for people who primary language is not English, mm-hmm. but also people who are culturally competent, including a pretty robust Native American group. And we have a Native American Services Committee, I think it's called. So, and they're regularly used throughout the hospital. So
thank you.
We have our own sweat lodge and smudge ceremonies and many things like that happening. So,
Grandpa, you stopped. How many staff do you have in the hospital? I know you're going to get to that later, but I'm wanting to make a
point. Currently, we have 1,773
okay.
Staff.
That's close enough.
Right.
And how long have you been at the hospital?
Almost exactly 2.5 years.
Okay.
Right.
And I think of turning the Titanic. The changes that Greg has made in the hospital has just been phenomenal, and I really want to compliment and acknowledge that it's really hard making the kinds of changes that he's making, and I think the staff applauds it, and I think the patients applaud it, and certainly the legislature applauds it. So
Representative Tomei, thank you. And I always appreciate when you say things like that, especially when my boss is in the room. But I always want to give credit. I have a very excellent team of people working directly for me, my chief medical officer, deputy superintendent, other department heads, and I think the transformation of the hospital is really due to that. It's at a leadership level, I think, and lean, the philosophy teaches this. It's leadership, leadership, leadership. And when you have the right people in leadership positions aimed at finding solutions to problems, you can make a lot of progress and pretty quickly. So I think that explains it. So,
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Yes, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We saw this up front and, up close and personal on our field trip. So I may suggest we may have another field trip.
I agree.
Yes.
I think that'd be a great idea.
With a sweat lodge included.
Sure.
What was that?
With a sweat lodge and smudging.
Sure. We specifically want to mention, because I'll show you in a minute slide, overtime reduction, major problem at the hospital historically. We applied, did some RPIs, rapid process improvement events to analyze the problem, understand the data, what was causing the problem. We have significantly reduced our overtime use and balanced our staffing schedules. We looked at our physician billing processes. Often we talk in terms of spending money. We also look to generate revenue wherever possible. And RPI reduced our steps in our processes by 28%. And that bottom line translates to a projected $2.5 million in revenue beyond a dollar amount that was projected for the biennium. So that's we expect to do that. Interpreter services, also we're able, by looking at our processes, we actually provide more in terms of hours of interpreter services. We provide more than a year ago at a lower at a lower cost. So we reduced the length of stay of 370 admissions by a week, 7 days on average less for 370 patients. Clinical assessments is the third bullet in terms of on-time rates for assessments. This relates to the PSRB process, a hearing process. We found several years ago that often the hospital went to a PSRB unprepared without the assessments that we knew or should have known the PSRB would be looking for. So the PSRB was not able to make a determination in cases because we didn't have our act together. And I would say at least for a year and a half now, no PSRB hearing had to be canceled or postponed because our assessments weren't done. And that was done by our clinical group. And then the fifth bullet has to do, it says MD recruitment, which is always a reflection of psychiatrist recruitment. Wonderful job done by a group of staff here, including psychiatrists on the front line, reducing our process time, how long it takes to recruit a doctor. We aspire, the number of doctors we aspire to have for the hospital is 41. We currently have 39. We have two people leaving us through retirement soon, and we have four people who will be in by early in the next biennium, and we will, for the first time in a long time, I would say, have all of our psychiatry positions filled, and the quality of the psychiatrists we're recruiting is really something. It's really excellent people. Slide 9 shows you graphically the reduction in overtime. The bulk of the overtime for the hospital is worked in the nursing department. We, back in September of 2011, we were using more than 30,000 hours per month, pretty steadily, certainly more than 25,000 hours a month. And we redistributed our staff sensibly through one of our lean events, and then came up with creative scheduling. Some of you heard about it the other day. Half of our staff work Monday to Friday and have every weekend off. The other half of our staff split the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday, Monday. The combination of those two things brought our overtime down in May of 2012. May or June was our low point. We've begun to creep back up, probably because of census increases over that time, but still nowhere near the 30,000 hours per month that we used to work. The next slide is my favorite slide. The reduction in mandatory overtime at the hospital, which was a significant problem back in 2009, 2010. The two steps that I just described actually were aimed more at eliminating mandatory overtime than reducing the amount of overtime, but it had both effects. And the numbers you see there are actual. So over 1,200 mandates in October 2011 became less than 200 in December 2012. A mandate is what a person being required to work an extra shift or part of a shift unexpectedly. So someone who's working, ready to leave at the end of their regular shift, suddenly being told they need to stay. So it's very undesirable from a lot of different points of view. But it's significant decrease there. If we were to add January 2013 or February 2013. It's actually crept up a little bit on us because we opened one additional unit or half of a unit, and our staffing hiring has to catch up to that. But we'll see that. That'll go back down. Slide 11 is the breakout of the staffing of the hospital. The number of managers, 144, represents 8% of the total, and the ratio is 1 to 11, which was established in the past biennium as a target figure, so we are right on that target number. The next slides show seclusion of patients, which we're often asked about. You see that the trend line there is upward, and Representative Tomei knows this from our hospital advisory board meetings. It's necessary to look at the total seclusions in combination with the seclusions without outliers. The seclusion without outliers removes from the data the very small number of our patients who are frequently, their behavior is so difficult that they're in seclusion or restraint. There are about 5 or 6 patients in the hospital who represent those outliers. So the trend line going up includes those outliers, and the page 13 has them out of the data. It's a very different picture, one compared to the other. Restraints on page 14 or 15 are the same, and those represent the same patients, actually. So, and those are episodes of restraint that the chart represents. Those pages relate to slide 16, where we look at injuries that occur from patient-to-staff aggression, and then the next page is patient-to-patient aggression. This is we're happy to see a downward trend here. 2011, these are broken. This is usually a color-coded page, but the first column is mild injury. A patient-to-staff aggressive act that resulted in an injury. Mild injury is the first column, moderate is the second, severe is the third. 2011 compared to 2012, mild injuries decreased by 20.5%, moderate injuries by 8.2%, and severe injuries by 20%, although the number there is small, 20 decreased to 16. On a broader view, 2010, there were about 77 incidents of aggression per month. Not all of them resulted in an injury, but in 2012, there were 56.7 per month. So from 77 a month to 56.7 per month over a 2-year period is also a 20% decrease.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you can attribute this successful outcome to?
Representative Tomei and Representative Kenny Dyer, the move to the new hospital, the environment of the new hospital is certainly a major contributor. There is more space for patients. Each patient bedroom has only 2 patients in it. In the past, there might be 4 or 5 patients crowded into a room. We emphasize the provision of active treatment, so our patients spend the majority of their day off their unit receiving programming and treatment in what's called the treatment mall, which is a centralized program area that I know some of you have seen. It's like a high school or college classroom type of arrangement. It's also, I think, due to training of our staff, which we have had some recent successes with, especially, but we have a lot more to do regarding the training of our staff. So it's a lot of factors. It's more staff, a better staff-to-patient ratio, especially on our difficult units, training, and the environment itself, I would say.
And one of the issues you touched on was overtime, and also yes, having to hire people from out of the hospital. Patients are much more comfortable with someone that they know and trust. So it seems to me, as I recall from our meetings, that there was less aggression.
Right. Representative, absolutely. The two things we did, the redistribution of staff and the weekday and weekend schedules, increase the likelihood that the same staff will be working on the same unit each day with the same patient. So that builds in a certain familiarity. The staff then can see early warning signs of escalating behavior and intervene earlier before the incident actually occurs. So that's also a factor, absolutely.
Representative David Gomberg.
David.
Goldberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talk to me a little bit, if you will, about the severe injuries that that our staff are experiencing there. I see 2011 we had 20, 2012, 16. I'm not sure what period of time we're looking at for 2013, but it looks like we're off to a distressing start with four already. I'd like to hear a little bit more about this. Severe lacerations, broken bones, head injuries, loss of limb, death. 16 to 20 a year?
Representative Tomei and Representative Gomberg. The four for 2013 is a moderate injury. There's zero severe injuries for 2013.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misread the... I didn't get the color right. I apologize for that.
Mine's a divided by two. But those... those are coded that way, so that would mean in a incident where a patient was aggressive and a staff member was injured, that the staff member suffered a severe laceration or a fracture. These are definitions of severe injuries. There may have been, I can tell you, there were zero deaths. There was zero loss of limbs. And a head injury, you would have concussion. So the majority of those would fall into concussions from time to time, a nasal fracture, I'm aware of some of them, or a severe laceration.
Yes. Thank you.
President Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm going to go back to Judiciary Committee because you're probably aware of this, but this is something that we heard on Judiciary a couple weeks ago. It's the issue of, because of the fourth degree assaults that are occurring in that environment, there was some concern about wanting to elevate them to a C felony, given that if the offense occurred to a member of the hospital, it would elevate that to a felony. And then also what would happen as a result, you know, the district attorney then would pursue that. Any thought on that, or have you been tracking that at all?
Representative Tomei and Representative Olson, it's an issue that's come up from time to time. From this point of view, that some of our patients, it's believed that their assault, the aggressive act on a staff member, is not a product of their mental illness. Sometimes it is. They're delusional or they're unstable, and the assault that takes place is the product of their mental illness, but sometimes it isn't. It's a belief that some patients, from time to time, deliberately, planfully assault a staff member. And it's infrequent, but I would say it does occur, and I think those are the issues that the people are discussing in terms of whether a person should be charged with a fourth degree crime as a result of that.
Okay. So. Well, I think the point was that why this bill is being presented was kind of more of a measure to protect, and I'm just...
Protect staff.
Yes. So, I mean, I'm just not connecting with what you're saying here on that.
Representative Tomei and Representative Olson, the supposition is, and I don't know if there's any literature or data that would support this, is on the sense that right now there are no significant consequences to a patient who deliberately, planfully assaults a staff member. And people believe that if the patient might know that they would be charged with a crime, that they would be dissuaded from the assault in the first place.
Okay, so I guess a follow-up thing on that, Madam Chair, is do you think that that's true?
In some instances, it's probably true. It's probably not true in every instance. I don't think it would drive the rate of the occurrences to zero.
So. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
The next page is patient injuries from patient to patient aggression. Same type of data, just sorted out for patients. Again, reductions from 2011 to 12, 8% for mild injuries, 27.9% decrease in moderate, and actually slightly up increased for well, it went from 2 to 3 in 2011 to 12. The last column there are unknown or undetermined. That's because the incident report that was filed did not indicate one way or the other whether someone was injured. So it's listed.
Greg, one of the things before we end this section of our hearing today, we're going to be hearing from PSRB.
If I could interrupt.
Yes.
You and I worked on those two bills. One came out of the Senate, one came out of the House, regarding limiting the door coming into the state hospital for PSR or for forensic patients and opening the door wider to let people out of the hospital into treatment in the community. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how that is working from your point of view.
That was 420. Yeah.
For the Representative Tomei, I would have to look at the admission figures for the year, but I know that the discharge conditional release figures from 2011 compared to 2012 are about the same. 94 discharges 1 year, 95 the second year. But off the top of my head, I can't think of the admission front door issue.
Yep. The other part of that was that the evaluators would be more, what's the word I'm looking for? It's have the same issues that they will be evaluating patients who would be admitted under the GEI, the guilty except for insanity. So that has happened, right? That has happened throughout the state?
The training, the certification of, that has happened, yes.
And has that made it easier for the hospital to admit patients or to see that people who would not be appropriate coming into the hospital might not be admitted under the GEI?
Representative Tomei, my understanding is that relates more to the 3-0 population, the ability to aid and assist, and our numbers, the number of evaluations that the Oregon State Hospital staff completed in 2012 was up, increased in 2012 compared to 2011. So I don't know if that can be correlated with the number of certified screeners in the community. Right now we just know the numbers were increasing.
My memory was that that would directly affect people who were being admitted to the hospital under guilty except for insanity.
We have the expert is sitting behind me, so she can answer.
And she says, you'll deal with that. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor.
The last slide, I just wanted to give you the committee a sense of where we're looking to move, again, continue the forward movement of the hospital and the improvements we made. We are looking to continue to increase the number of beds that are certified by a CMS program, again, given a new facility, emphasis on active treatment, protection, better job of protection from harm, et cetera. We believe that more of our units can be certified and therefore draw down more federal dollars. We want to, although we're doing a much better job of providing treatment on our treatment malls, we want it to be more person-centered, meaning based on what the patient themselves say works for them, type of treatment that they desire. We want to use evidence-based practices. These are particular clinical methodologies that have been proven to have predictable outcomes, so that basically almost if we provide this program in this way to this patient population, we can predict the outcome for those patients. And although we have many of our patients in vocational programs, we want to increase our vocational program as well, because the patients who leave the hospital are often able post-discharge to be employed, and therefore we want to make sure we do a good job of preparing them for jobs in the community when they leave. We want to expand our family programs. We've been doing that, especially this past year. The Hospital Advisory Board had one particular group focus on that. And probably most importantly, as I mentioned before, focus on workforce development. As I said earlier in the week to another committee, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the number of staff employed at the hospital was a contributing factor to the problems at the hospital. I would say today it is not. That is not a factor. We have sufficient staffing to do the job we expect to do, but our staff need quite a bit of training to develop their competencies, to have the skills to work with the population that we work with. So we don't want to assume that 2 weeks of orientation give you all the training you need to do the job we expect you to do. So that's a real point of emphasis for the next biennium. So.
So one last question maybe. So as a result of those two bills that were passed in 2011, there was supposed to be an advisory board in the hospital that would advise when people are ready to leave the hospital. So how has that function
Representative Tomei, you're probably referring to the State Hospital Review Panel.
Yes.
For the Tier 2.
Right.
It's functioned very well. We created our legal affairs department, hired Mickey Logan to run that department, created this State Hospital Review Panel, and they function pretty much in a parallel fashion to the PSRB, but for a different patient population. So they've done the job that was expected from the bill. So, resulting in discharges and conditional releases, et cetera.
And so there haven't been any hang-ups in getting people discharged? They've been able to be discharged on time?
If the question is, Representative Tomei, the question is, when people are declared, we term them ready to place, and that's defined when their treatment team says they're ready to leave.
Right.
That is double-checked by what we call our risk review panel, and then approved by PSRB or SHARP, depending for Tier 1, Tier 2. Then we consider the person ready to place. Then we start making referrals to community agencies for placement, and we monitor those numbers. So it does not translate into a situation where every person who's ready to place leaves the hospital within a week or anything like that. There's a process that you need to go through. And I think I referenced the other day, we count about 34 patients in the hospital right now who are in the process of being evaluated for community placement. But we realize that there are not 34 beds necessarily available today for those people.
So that is sort of a holdup, having those beds ready in the community.
Ideally, Representative Tomei, I think there would always be, from the moment that a person is declared ready to place, there will always be a time frame where you need to do the referral and acceptance process in the community. Right now, we draw that line about 90 days. We're thinking that process would take 90 days. So we keep data on how many people are waiting more than 90 days.
And so at some point, could you come back and sort of give us the exact information on that? Because I think what we've been hearing from patients, certainly, and sometimes from staff, is that when placements aren't available, the patient gets really frustrated. I've done what it was I needed to do, and now you need to help get me into the community.
Right.
So if we could have more information on that, that would be helpful.
Certainly.
Great. Thank you very much. Any last questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was very impressive.
Thank you. Thank you for a great job. Mary Claire.
Thank you. Very generous of you.
Yeah, now we got the...
That's right.
Fortunately,
oh, Mary,
I'm
Mary,
from East Coast and I can talk fast.
Oh, yeah, thank you for talking fast.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Claire Buckley and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. I have provided, and your purposes, Representative Gallegos, this is not a rehash, but a preview, because you're going to see me on Monday afternoon as well, but hopefully we'll cover a little different stuff today. My intent was to give you a little overview of what the PSRB does and then talk about those issues, Representative Tomei, that you've been raising, so I'm going to speak quickly. I've given you a handout that gives you an overview. I'm not going to walk you through those at this point, just to say for those new members that the PSRB was created in 1978. For 30 years, its sole purpose was to assume jurisdiction over persons who were successfully asserted the insanity defense to a crime in Oregon, both felonies and misdemeanors. In 2007, the board's responsibilities expanded to a juvenile panel, and in 2009, we also received responsibility for gun relief hearings. But for purposes of today's discussion, we're going to only focus on the adult GEI population. So as a result of some changes that were mentioned both by Greg and by Representative Tomei, are with, as a result of that legislation last session, PSRB now has the jurisdiction over persons found guilty except for insanity of a Tier 1 offense, which are the murders in ballot measure 11 crimes, as well as anybody on conditional release. And the Tier 2 individuals are, while they're in the hospital, are the responsibility of the SHARP panel. Those two bills, the 420 took care of separating out the responsibilities for the tiers of offenders. Right now, there are about 450 Tier 1 offenders, of which 250 are on conditional release, and Tier 2 has a total of 250 clients, of which 150 are on conditional release ballpark. So there's 100 in the hospital for SHARP, and the rest in the hospital, about just a little less than 200, are the PSRBs. With regards to House Bill 3100, which was to address the front door, yes, in fact, the certification process has been completed. We did the rules, did the trainings in conjunction with AMH, and those individuals, about 112 psychologists and psychiatrists, have been certified to provide the evaluations for forensic clients, both GEI and 370s. The intent of that was to improve and to make sure that the right people were sent to the state hospital for the purpose to make sure that they met the criteria for the insanity defense, and also just to be sure that those reports included certain information, because the disparity in those reports prior to, you know, this this rule was pretty substantial. So that's in place. To your question, Representative Tomei, I think it's a little too early because the training just finished in August, so we're just starting to see the reports that those individuals have been trained on now to include that information in their reports. But from our reading of a few new ones, they are addressing those aspects that have been set forth in the rule, which I think is an improvement, including malingering, for example, to make sure that people aren't faking. So I think we expect that that will have an effect in the future. We don't take misdemeanors. That is the difference with 3100. Misdemeanors were taken from our jurisdiction. It was a small percentage. We still have seven left under the board because they had consecutive sentences of up to six in a row. So, but none of those are in the state hospital. So those beds, no misdemeanors, are in the state hospital anymore for that, for the GEI. And then for the mandatory community mental health evaluations that were part of that, we received 58 new GEIs last year, and that's for both PSRB and SHARP, just GEIs. About 39% of those were for C felons, and eight of those were placed on court conditional release. And that's eight out of 10. The number that were placed on court conditional release last year was small, but interestingly, 80% of them were for the C. So if you want to extrapolate that that's having an effect, that I will tell you that Mickey and Logan and myself spent a great deal of time last spring and fall going around the state trying to educate the defense attorneys, DAs, and judges, as well as local mental health people, on the changes to this so that they would be aware of the intent of this and hopefully use these opportunities to try and keep people who don't need to be sent to the state hospital from going there. Those were the changes to the PSRB under 3100 and 420. The rest of the statute remained the same. The board's purpose is the same. Their mission remains the same, which is basically to assume jurisdiction and to protect the public through the ongoing review of those individuals and to make a determination of their appropriate placement. They get these folks from the criminal justice system. People assert the defense successfully. The court then decides whether, in fact, they're going to have to go to the hospital or whether they can be remain in the community on a conditional release. Once that's done, the court system is out of it, and either the board or the panel takes over all future decision-making about the status of these folks. The board's three priorities were to be would be, as a result of the statute, is to conduct hearings, to monitor the progress of those in the, who have been conditionally released into the community, and to facilitate conditional release. And we do that through two arenas, the hearings process, and again, the monitoring. And the board holds hearings based on the statutory timeframes that are in the enabling statute. At each hearing, they make a decision not only about jurisdiction, but about whether they are, in fact, ready to be sent back to the community. The hospital determines or recommends that they are, after going through that risk review process that Greg mentioned, and the board agrees, then an evaluation would be sent to a community mental health agency, and that's where this whole system works together. It's not just the hospital or the PSRB, but also the community mental health agencies are involved, and we have probably clients in probably 22 counties in the state right now on conditional release. So then the community will evaluate this person and determine, independent of the hospital, whether they agree with the hospital that this person is ready, and if so, what conditions they would recommend the board to impose. If they say yes, comes back to the board, board holds a hearing, and then the individual is moved to the community. And then once they're out, our other function is to monitor them. And so we have monthly reports, we have daily correspondence with case managers, as well as we have a LEDS terminal in our office that will notify us if there's any police contact in the community with our clients. As long as they remain stable in the community, they're going to stay out and progress through, hopefully, you know, lower levels of care and lower levels of required treatment. However, if somebody were to violate their conditions such that they posed a danger or their mental health were to decompensate to the point where we couldn't manage it in a community setting, then they, the board has the ability to send them back to the state hospital on a revocation. That's basically the overview of how we work. Representative Tomei had asked me to discuss a little bit about some of the issues that we're facing at this point. I think I talked a little bit about 3100 in terms of how that's going. But I would say for the 3100, from my perspective, and it ties into, frankly, the second piece that I was going to talk about, which is the budget note work group for Senate Bill 5529, is that in order for people to avail themselves of that, the Class C evaluation and conditional release, there has to be a placement available in the community. And if we don't have open beds, then there is no place for the court to court conditionally release them to. And in a couple of those cases, I will tell you that I think we said 10 went to the courts. C felons were committed to the state hospital. And in looking at those, there were a couple that could have been avoided if the community had a bed available at the time of the disposition of the, you know, by the trial court. And so I'm not quite sure how we're doing it. We're struggling with trying to figure out how you can have a bed available for these people when they have their court hearing. The second one I want to raise with you is the results of the budget note work group. This legislature gave AMH a directive to hold a work group on what the needs of residential placements might be. We reported that to the legislature. But, you know, from my perspective, it doesn't do any good unless somebody then, you know, in this body, funds the recommendations that have been made. That group met several times. It was, you know, a representative of all the stakeholders, and they indicated, you know, they made some findings that we need additional residential treatment homes in the counties where there are secure residentials, because, you know, you need a place to step down. People who go to secure aren't going to step from a secure most of the time to independent or semi-independent living. They need, you know, we do it in a graduated process that we think works best for the clients. And so that was one of the recommendations. Another was to set up crisis respite centers, either in the counties where most of our you know, clients are conditionally released, or at least a regional system, so that I have a place short of the hospital to send people if they are in need of, you know, that kind of, you know, crisis treatment without using a state hospital bed. And, you know, the benefit for that is not only for the state hospital, but for the client as well, because they don't lose their bed, they don't lose their benefits, they don't have to start all over. Because, you know, once they get revoked, frankly, they're going to stay, and I know that you noted the revocations, and Greg pointed that out, but the problem with the revocations is we have a hearing in 20 days. If they haven't recompensated, then the board's going to find them appropriate when they do, but in the meantime, the communities don't get paid for vacancies anymore. So what happens is they have to fill that bed. So the person who got revoked and gets, you know, recompensated then has to wait, you know, in line to get another bed space, because you can't hold that bed for the 2 or 3 months it might take to, you know, get them stabilized. So it's, you know, the revocations, the number of people that appears to be in the hospital as a result of revocations is because they go back to the, you know, back of the line if that bed has already been filled. So if, you know, been urging, I will tell you that we use local hospitals a lot, but they're not willing to keep our clients on a long-term basis. I can get them to hold them for the 5 days, maybe on a civil commitment hold, but once, you know, that, if that hasn't been enough time, they're going to ask me to, you know, take them and send them to the state hospital, and that happened today. So, and the other one was some, you know, to make available the specialty treatment and for special populations. For example, you know, sex offenders are obviously a big problem in placing in the community. And at one point, we thought about setting up a home for that population. And you can well imagine we didn't get too far in setting up one because of, you know, nobody wants that in their neighborhood. So rather than that, we, you know, we're hoping that we could use existing resources, but, you know, make sure that the money is there to pay for those services they need, you know, the sex offender treatment or whatever other supports and services they need to be treated in that kind of facility. My other point is that, you know, my suggestion would be, for what it's worth, to have some dedicated flexible funding for guilty except for insanity patients. If it was this new money from, you know, mental health that may be available. You know, sometimes the person's out in the community and just needs, you know, additional supports and services for a short, for a period of time. You know, we have people that have health issues or something temporarily. If we could add staffing for a period of time rather than send them to the hospital, it certainly would be, once again, better for the client and cheaper for the state. And, you know, right now there is not a dedicated, I believe that in long ago, there used to be a PSRB line item in AMH's budget. And for those who aren't familiar, how this was set up originally was the PSRB budget just pays for the hearings, the board, you know, lights and the rent and what have you, and the salaries of staff, but that the money for the care and treatment of our clients is in AMH's budget. And it used to have a line item, then they took it out and just sort of left the whole thing for all community, mental health care and treatment. But then you're competing, and sometimes, I mean, right now, I think Linda would tell you, you know, they're tapped out, and we're still in need at times of money to just, you know, target a particular person or situation for a period of time, and so I think that would be helpful. And I did add one more that I would ask you to consider that came up the other day, and which is not on the slide here. But it's also the issue of paying for these community evaluations. Historically, community mental health agencies have not been paid for conducting these evaluations, which I have to tell you are, you know, take substantial time, energy, and effort. We ask the community, I send the community the entire PSRB exhibit file. We ask them to review that entire file, to meet with the client face-to-face, to write a report, and then to send that to the board.
And you're talking about community mental health,
yes,
right? Or county mental health?
County mental health agencies.
Okay, thank you.
And, you know, for a long time, it's been sort of considered to be, you know, a cost of doing business that you got to do that in order to get your client. Well, now there's some, you know, at least some I wouldn't say pressure, but some push to have, and so as a result of that, the board has not often ordered more than one evaluation at a time. Because I will tell you, I talked to some folks, they would estimate, you know, more than $1,500, because most of our providers now are involving a treating psychiatrists as part of that evaluation process. And that doctor reviews the file, it meets with them, and writes a report, too. So we're talking, you know, 12, 15 hours worth of work that goes into this stuff, not counting transportation if they have to come to the state hospital. And I will tell you, you know, the hospital takes people in the close areas, but Curry County, we're opening a new place down there now, and Curry County staff had to come up. It took them a day to get here. Yep. They did a day here, and they had to drive back a day. And that's 3 days, and we're not, you know, compensating for that. And
Rick, so you talk so fast. I think maybe you're leaving some people out in your dust. But I want to make clear that what you're talking about is someone who's ready to leave the hospital, and we're asking county mental health or the provider,
yes,
of this bed in a mental health pardon? What's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, facility.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. And so so it takes all this time to evaluate one person, mm-hmm, and one placement. If it does, that person doesn't fit that placement, then that the mental health agency and the community provider is saying, I've wasted a lot of time on that. And the patient in the hospital was ready to go, saying, well, take me to a couple of three different places, and one of them will provide a space for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a catch-22.
Right.
It's very difficult.
Sure. And, you know, I think that if at least we compensate them, it would, you know, go a ways in,
right,
allowing them, I mean, or getting them to agree to do more than one, because, you know, there's been suggestions of sending out 2, 3, 4, 5 evaluations. I don't think we want to go that far, but certainly multiple evaluations to facilities that meet the, you know, similarly meet the person's needs. And if we send them out simultaneously, what the problem with only sending one out at a time, which I will freely admit, is that if they say no, you got to start it again, and it's going to take that much time. And the board, or the panel, has already said this person could go, but for whatever reason, whether it's resources or whatever reason, some agency doesn't take them, you got to start it all over again. And so I understand why it would be, you know, more productive to have more than one out, but at the same time,
there's a question.
And is that the process that takes 90 days typically?
At least.
So that's why you'd want a couple going once. And may I follow up with
the question? Representative Tomei. Representative
Tomei. Sorry. End of the long week. We're being informal. You mentioned 6 different recommendations, 5 that came out of the work group and 1 that you added on.
Mm-hmm.
Are any of those in the governor's budget for the expanded community mental health services?
Representative Tomei, Representative Kenegaya, I do not know that. I will tell you that what I do know is that in the AMA 2, and whoops, one's not there. Can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that there is only one 5-bed facility in AMH's budget for community growth next biennium. I will also tell you that this biennium, there was a net loss of residential beds. We did not gain a bed this biennium. And as a result, there were only 52 conditional releases last year. The year before we did 94, I believe. So there is, you know, if you look at the, yes, so last, in 2012, both Tier 1 and Tier 2, there were 62 conditional releases. 2011, there were 94. But if you look, it's because the year, biennium before, there had been investment in a number of new developments.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, we only got 1 5-bed that hasn't even opened yet in this biennium. And then we lost 6 beds. So it was a net loss. And we just, you know, the system can't afford to be losing if you want them to move out of the hospital, I guess is my, you know.
So, yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, you have a serious compression issue,
mm-hmm,
going on. I mean, you got bulges.
Representative Olson,
yeah,
yes. And, you know, there are, you got to have that in order to keep it moving. It's hydraulic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, when you don't have the development, then it sort of stalls, and then the hospital gets to the point where, and with a smaller hospital, they don't have, and they, you know, the pressure's there, and they don't want them coming, or we don't want them to get out, and so it's just that whole scene. So, so that's basically my pitch, is that if there's anything that this, you know, committee can do to help allocate funds for those particular and specific purposes, so that, you know, it's almost, I mean, I hate to be Hal Gore, but a lockbox or something that makes sure that, you know, the funding is there for those purposes, I think that we could move more people. Right now, as Greg said, we have 17, and I believe they have 10, so 17 that have been approved by the board for, you know, for conditional release, and another 10 that are in the evaluation process. So 27 for PSRB, and then SHARP has some as well, that, you know, we want to keep this.
It's frustrating for the patients and the staff and everybody who works with them, and they're ready to leave and there's nothing out there for them to go to. So for some people who haven't been on this committee before, tell us how much it costs per patient to keep people in the community. Just a broad ballpark figure.
Representative Tomei, that would vary from, the Secures obviously are the most expensive. They're probably $12,000-$13,000 a month, you know, service payment, but that is Medicaid matchable, so it doesn't cost the state anywhere near that. All the way down to, you know, the supported housing, you know, might be the cost of one staff person, you know, one shift of a staff person. You know, the residential treatment homes, probably the service payment is around $5,000 a month, you know, ballpark, there's some a little higher, some lower, I'm sure, but a ballpark, $5,000 for a residential treatment home, which also would be Medicaid match. And all of the places in the community, you know, could have Medicaid match.
Which is usually, what, 50%?
Now it's probably 60-something, I think, right
60
now.
60 from CMS, 40 OHP?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I should have asked you while you're here, Greg, but I'll ask Mary Clay, because you probably know, how much does it cost to keep a patient in the hospital?
Representative Tomei, I believe it's about $21,000 a month.
And do we get any Medicaid match for that?
No, not unless they're on the general ward.
So I'm wondering if somebody from Ways and Means Committee will understand this and is writing this down. And it's more humane, it's certainly less expensive to get people out in that community.
We just need to have the resources.
Yes. Yes. Any quick questions of Mary Claire? And Mary Claire, maybe there's something that some of us can work with you on, and the hospital, and maybe mental health also. And I see somebody is here from county mental health program. Maybe it's time that we started doing something to provide more placements in the community.
Representative Tomei, that would be greatly appreciated. Some of the funding for this.
Okay. Any last questions? All right. Thank you very much, Mary Claire. Thank you all that came today and stayed. And with that, we will close the informational hearing on the Oregon State Hospital and Oregon Mental Health and Oregon Health Authority, and close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And have a great weekend, everybody.